Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Today, we're kicking things off, digging into some important information to help you connect with your garden and landscape while serving your community through the UConn Master Gardeners Program. We'll tell you all about it and how to get signed up for their next round of certification training for 2022. Then we're going to meet a Southern Litchfield County nonprofit that's bringing unique and successful equine therapies to folks on the autism spectrum and who are suffering from disabilities. So saddle up with us and learn more about Little Britches Therapeutic Riding Program and how you can get involved. Then we're going to check in with the Shoreline Arts Alliance, bringing big news and involving and supporting all kinds of artistic projects and artists throughout the region and the state. If you're a photographer, we're also going to explain how to enter your best work in the Alliance's Images, Photography, Exhibition, and Competition. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder from our good friends at the Courage to Speak Foundation and our friend Ginger Katz. They've launched a new website for Sunny's story that includes audio excerpts from the book, a family album with photos, testimonials, and so much more. This Sunny's story is a compelling tale for children, teens, parents, grandparents, and educators, written by Ginger Katz, that tells of joyful times and sad times and how a dog's best friend was needlessly lost. It's narrated through the eyes, ears, and mind of Sonny, the family beagle. It chronicles the ups and downs of life with his young master, beginning with their meeting at an animal shelter and ending with a futile effort to ward off disaster. You can learn more about this drug prevention storybook for all ages right now at sonnystory.com. That's SunnysStory.com. Well, here we are in the first weekend of fall 2021, and yet while some people are thinking about getting out their equipment to begin planning how they're going to be getting rid of their falling leaves and maybe even preparing for winter maintenance, we're already looking forward to all that's going to be blooming and making Connecticut more beautiful in 2022. And we've got the perfect guest to help us do that. Sarah Bailey is here. She is the state program coordinator for UConn's Master Gardener Program, as well as the Hartford County Master Gardener Coordinator. And as regular listeners or longtime listeners may know, the Master Gardeners program out of UConn has been a great friend and resource to the award-winning For the People. So we're so excited to get Sarah back on as we start the recruitment drive for the 2022 Master Gardeners Certification Program. So there's lots to talk about, and we will bring Sarah into the conversation. Sarah, thanks for joining us this morning.
My pleasure. Good to be back again.
This is fantastic. But for folks that may not be familiar with the Master Gardeners program, could you give them a quick kind of overview and history? Because you guys have been doing this now for decades plus.
Absolutely. I'd be glad to. The program started in the Northwest United States in 1972 when one of the first big pushes towards home gardening and interest in home gardening and growing your own vegetables started, and extension agencies at the time realized they really didn't have what we now refer to as consumer horticulture people. So the program was developed to train enthusiastic gardening volunteers in the basic concepts of gardening and horticulture, who would then turn around and fundamentally help the community with all of their gardening and horticulture questions. So it was really early consumer horticulture, all done by volunteers. And we started here in Connecticut a little over 40 years ago.
And you did really kind of strike the difference there by reinforcing consumer. Although this is an academic this program emanates in terms of training from one of our premier academic institutions at UConn. This is not a training specifically for folks that are studying biology or horticulture. This really is for the average person who not only might want to get into or already really enjoys gardening or landscaping, but it gives them an extra edge because it provides them with this real broad base of education that they can then turn around and sort of, you know, it's a train the trainer kind of thing. They can turn around in their own communities. And in fact, I guess as part of the completion of the training, they're required to spearhead a community project in their own neighborhood or town.
That's correct. It is a significant academic education that one gets. It really is a good broad view of almost all of the tenets of horticulture, but it's designed for really the average individual who has a passion for, one, for gardening, but two, for teaching and sharing that with the community. And as you said, as part of the certification process, everybody has to spend a particular number of hours working in the community on projects ranging from helping with a community garden to working with kids in schools, invasives management, working with museum properties that want to have their garden spaces appropriate to the time period of whatever that museum is about.
Sure, historical
societies. So it's all about sharing it.
Yeah, that's great. Well, like a lot of our guests here that we've talked to over the past 6 to 8 months, certainly the onset of COVID-19 was problematic to disastrous, depending on who you're talking to. However, the silver lining for a measurable number of organizations has been that their pivot to virtual use of technology to communicate between the organizations and their constituents has actually created both greater engagement and more widespread participation. And I understand that that may have been the case with the Master Gardeners program as well.
Absolutely. We had already pre-COVID developed our program into what's referred to as a hybrid class, where some of the work is done online asynchronously, and then you have an in-class lab session, if you will, where you take that academic material that you've learned and you figure out how to apply it to real life. And so when COVID came around, we obviously had to change that and make it all online, but we were able to do that, and the last year was entirely online. And while we all want to get back to where we're hands-on and we're sharing face-to-face, certainly hope next year we'll be able to do that, we discovered that we really were reaching a much wider population. Folks who worked could perhaps, because it was part of it was all of it was asynchronous, or part of it was asynchronous, could do it in their free time. People didn't have the distance restrictions of where they lived versus where a class was. And so not only for the program, but for the other classes that we do, because we do a variety of one-time classes on gardening topics, those we had tremendous response with because nobody had to drive to the specific location to take it. So online will always be, virtual will always be a part of our program from now on.
Yeah, do you think?
Not entirely, but a part.
Do you think that the byproduct of COVID-19 for many home and property owners, above and beyond participation in the Master Gardener program, has kind of created a new benchmark or maybe a bubble of interest that will be sustainable in terms of people suddenly doing home gardening, home gardens, raising their own vegetables and food, maybe even getting into beekeeping or chickens you know, maybe even folks on the shore experimenting with some kind of like low-level aquaculture? I mean, has this been a good thing?
Again, this is somewhat cyclical. In the 70s, we had that same sort of back-to-the-land move and urge, and that it ebbs and flows. But certainly COVID had everybody reconnecting with the world around them, unable to go to work, unable to do the normal life. They looked at where they were and said, let's make this something we can be a part of, we can control. Gardening became incredibly popular. You talk to any of the local garden centers, and they'll tell you the last two seasons have been just crazy, crazy good.
Yeah.
If
you could get the stuff.
Exactly. That was the problem. Right? Could they get enough material?
Yeah, and then the seed shortages and things?
Yeah. So, yes, I think there has been this big movement back towards growing your own material, impacting your own space in positive ways. And I certainly hope that it's going to continue. And that's what we're here to help people do.
Excellent. Well, we mentioned the 2022 certification. So let's turn to a little bit of talk about that. Let folks know wherever they may be listening to us in Connecticut and perhaps beyond, if there are similar programs in Rhode Island, Massachusetts, or New York, in Long Island, how they can maybe sign on for 2022 certification.
Sure. Yeah. Sure. We hold the program. We have five cohorts. So there's a program with either in-person or, we hope, class every day of the week. And so we're going to have classes in Torrington. Let me see if I can get this right. Torrington, Tolland, New London, New Haven, and down in Stamford at the Bartlett Arboretum.
Mm-hmm.
The New Haven class, which will be Thursday evenings, will be entirely online, both the academic side and the quote-unquote in-class portion.
Mm-hmm.
All of the other classes, we hope, will be in person with the class time 9 to 1 on the given day of the week that they are held.
Mm-hmm.
And more information and more details can certainly easily be found at mastergardener.ucon.edu, which is our website. That's mastergardener, all one word, .ucon.edu.
And we mentioned it earlier, but the exciting thing for everyone else around the individual who's becoming certified is that they need to apply themselves to a community service type project. Talk just for a minute about those and some of the really cool ones that you've seen or heard about in recent years.
Sure. I'll preface that with you have class one day a week for 16 weeks. It's January through April.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start your outreach. Some of which is done within our offices, answering phones, answering gardening questions, helping folks with those. And then the other half is done with these outreach projects. And we've had some tremendous ones over the years. We've worked with the Mark Twain House here in Hartford to get their gardens and their property consistent to the era of Mark Twain. We've done, I'm trying to think of some of the really cool projects. We've done a lot with pollinator pathways and pollinator gardens in the last few years, taking spaces, generally public spaces, and removing the non-native and the invasive materials and bringing in the plantings that will support pollinators and other wildlife in the area so that we're recreating those ecosystems that will enhance the environment, make sure you get healthy bird populations and healthy insect populations, because believe it or not, most of the insects are good guys. We've done projects with other historical organizations. We do a lot along the shoreline. We do a lot with some of the parks down there.
Right. Well, you mentioned pollinators, and we may circle back to that, but the other thing that's really awesome about the Master Gardener, once certified and trained, is even after their public involvement, if they really turn their attention more inward to their own properties, they are inadvertently benefiting their entire neighborhoods or communities because they are really stepping up the practice of sustainable gardening and landscaping, which is in effect creating a greater and more sustainable environment for their own neighborhoods and communities.
Absolutely. And I would say not inadvertently, it's with great thought.
Ah.
The intent is not only to beautify your own space, to enrich your own space, but to enrich your community around you.
I guess I should have said unsuspectingly. Things get better thanks to Master Gardeners, right?
Yeah, our whole goal is enriching the community in all sorts of different ways.
Great. Well, we want to take the last 3 or 4 minutes that we have with you, Sarah Bailey, to also tap you for a quick little lesson for anyone who's listening, whether they're able to get involved with the Master Gardeners program at UConn or not. And that's to talk about invasives, because I see more and more through press releases and activities and events and notifications from folks like the Extension Services that in invasives are really proliferating and taking hold here in Connecticut, and they are doing real and sometimes permanent damage to our environment. What are a few of the things that people who may be listening can do to better recognize invasives and try to combat them in their own space?
There are a couple of things. First of all, we're dealing with two different sets of invasives that are problems, plant invasives and insect invasives. Both of those, we have several in Connecticut that are problems. Mostly it's education and understanding what happens when you plant a plant that is not native to our area. And by native, I mean it didn't develop in this area alongside the insect and animal population. So what happens is you bring in a really cool plant from somewhere else in the world because you like what it looks like. And there's no control for that plant because everything eats something. Mm-hmm. Every plant in the world has something that eats it, and that's what keeps it in control. So if you don't have that control, the plant can proliferate. And you have certain ones that just really good seed dispersal. The birds like the seeds and spread them around. And some of them are illegal to have to plant in this area. That would be bittersweet. That would be Japanese knotweed. But the sticky piece is that there are a lot of plants that are still legal to sell and to buy in this state that are not good ideas to have. And they're very popular plants. They're things like burning bush, which is gorgeous this time of year, but spreads and outcompetes other plants. Things like barberry, which everybody loves for its purple foliage. But the seeds spread and get everywhere and, again, outcompete native plants. And the native plants are what our insect population needs. And our insect population is what things like birds need in order to thrive. So it's always important to understand where a plant came from and understand its capabilities. And always a good idea when a tag says something grows easily, spreads easily, think twice.
So I guess the final tip would be, is there one particular invasive that a homeowner or property owner may be able to identify that is relatively easy to control or eliminate?
Unfortunately, no, because that's part of the problem with invasives. They're not easy to control.
Okay.
The two that people are going to see are Japanese knotweed, which is blooming right now all along the roadsides. Big, stately plant with lovely, fluffy flower plumes.
Yeah.
And then bittersweet, which is that really pretty yellow and orange berry on a vine that everybody sees this time of year. Lots of people like to make them into wreaths and things like that.
Yeah.
But those are the ones that when you see them, get rid of them. If you see them on your property, pull them. Get rid of them. And because if all of us make the effort to control them in our space, we may never eradicate them, but we may be able to keep them manageable.
Very good. The UConn Extension Master Gardeners program is an educational outreach initiative, part of the UConn Extension, started in 1978. You'll get horticulture training and an outreach component that focuses on your community and neighborhood at large. As you can hear from our guest, Sarah Bailey, who's with the program, master gardeners are quite enthusiastic, willing to learn and to share their knowledge and training with others, neighbors, community members, local groups, museums, and things like that. It's a great program. We are so pleased to be able to promote them as often as we can here on For the People. And we thank you, Sarah Bailey. Sarah is the state program coordinator for the Master Gardener program. Once again, please learn more at mastergardener.ucon.edu. And Sarah, good luck with your 2022 program, and we'll be talking to you again soon. So like we said in the introduction, we're going to meet a brand new friend to the award-winning For the People. We love making new friends, especially when it's such an interesting and effective program that we're helping to promote. I'm talking about Little Britches Therapeutic Riding Program. This organization was founded back the year I graduated high school in 1979 by a couple of interested individuals, and it's grown into a fantastic nonprofit that provides equine assistance assisted riding and driving initiatives, which allow people who are physically, emotionally, developmentally, or economically challenged to interact with horses in a variety of ways. And there's no better person to be able to help relate what incredible things that Little Britches is doing for its participants than Melissa Johnson. She has been involved with this program almost since its inception, if not right up to its inception. She's had a 23-year relationship with Little Britches, and she has been a board member of this organization and nonprofit for some time. So, Melissa, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So tell us how you first learned about Little Britches.
Well, I saw it actually in our local paper 23 years ago. There was a tiny little ad. It said, you know, if you have a child with a disability, we have a therapeutic riding program. And I grew up with horses. So I was like, ooh, let's try this. So my oldest son was 3. I brought him up. They tried him out. They start children at age 3, nobody younger. I already had my other son, who was 2 at the time. We brought him up the same day, and my 3-year-old at the time, he got on. The first day, he cried. The second day, he went back. It was perfect.
Didn't want to leave.
He's been riding ever since. Didn't want to leave, exactly.
And, I bet
and
the
then
two,
a year later,
yeah,
my other son. I'm
yeah,
sorry.
I bet the 2-year-old was like, when? When
yeah,
can I do
exactly.
It?
It was a whole year, and then he's been riding ever since also. So 23 years and 21 and a half years, respectively, they've been riding.
Great. Well, from your perspective, you have seen these young men now develop with an equine component in their lives, virtually all their lives. Tell us a little bit about that person horse connection. I mean, plenty of people have seen movies, and it's a kind of a cliched thing going back centuries, but I mean, when it's somebody with a disability, somebody on the spectrum, magic happens.
Absolutely. For my older son, both of my children are nonverbal with autism. One is completely never said a word. The older one tries. He talked a little bit, lost it, talked a little bit. He seems to open up more when he's on the horse. He's actually learned more words riding the horse than when he's at speech therapy when he was still in school. So we would introduce new words to him, and he would be able to properly pronounce them. He learned how to use not traditional sign languages, but gesturing so he can communicate with the horse. So that's an amazing thing. When they're on the horse, their whole body changes. Like if they're stressed when they get there or they're anxious, you see them sit on this horse and everything is just physically released. Now, my younger one, he had a lot of trunk issues, like core issues, very low tone. He was diagnosed with low tone. When you're on a horse, when you're walking, your body actually moves exactly the way you would as a person walking. So it builds up your core structure, and it helps your hips move correctly. So that gives people who have low tone and issues with muscle tone that the right type of exercise without having to actually do it by yourself. So you're on that horse, and you're getting that right exercise for your upper body. Mm. It's amazing. It took a few years, because he was always laying on the horse and we had to hold him up. But once he got his core strength, now he starts sitting up. And the same thing with him. When he was having anxiety, you get him on the horse, it's like, okay, I'm good. Thank you. Oh, I needed that. You can see it in their faces.
Also, help explain to our listeners about these horses, because it sounds like they kind of almost have to be recruited for temperament and maybe specifically trained to react to a completely nonverbal rider.
Absolutely. Most of the horses are of the age, they're teenage years or above. So we have horses anywhere from like age about 15 to about 25 that work. They are typically horses that have been retired from either another farm or just they're aging. So they don't want to have to you know, run and do a lot of hard work or any farm work. So they just have a temperament about them. But they do have to be looked at and studied by the therapist. You know, the therapist can't just take any horse and say, yep, you're going to work. Once we've required a horse, then it takes quite a long time for the therapist to work with that horse to make sure that they can be the right temperament. Because just like people, some horses don't work well with other some of our riders, and vice versa. And physically, some of our horses have to be a little bit bigger for our older clientele. But mostly we have ponies because a lot of our little guys who ride physically need to be held. So you need to have sidewalkers that can actually reach.
Right.
So our ponies technically have to be a shorter stature, but we do have a couple larger ones because, like, my children are big. They're adults.
So it's
a lot of work.
So what's the ratio between children and adults today in Little Britches Therapeutic Riding Program?
I'm probably going to say about 25-30% are above the 18 mark.
Oh, okay. So predominantly younger people.
Yeah, predominantly younger. And when they first started back 40-plus years ago, you know, we came, like, you know, like I said, 23 years ago, and they didn't have anybody riding past the age of 15 because they didn't have the horses.
Oh.
And as my children were aging through the program, I'm like, oh, geez, I'm going to have to find another program. They're like, no, we now have the facility that we have a bigger horse. And they found bigger horses. And then my children never had to leave. It was such a blessing for my family.
Super. Well, before we take a quick break and then meet Marcy, another representative of the organization, tell us more about the therapists and the other professionals that work with the program.
Okay, so we have an executive director who's also the head equine trainer. She is the head therapist. We have two other certified equine therapists. We also have OTs and PTs on staff as needed for certain children. And then we have volunteers. That's what we always look for. We look for volunteers who can sidewalk, people who, if they don't have experience, we'll train them. We train them every season. We also need people who are called leads, people who will volunteer just to have the reins of the horses as they walk. We're always looking for volunteers, but all of our, like, staff that we actually pay are all certified staff. So we have an amazing team. Wonderful. Like I said, we have three therapists. They're equine therapists. And then we have OTs and PTs.
That's okay. No, I was going to say, so it sounds to me like people who may have always wanted to be around horses or work with horses can come to Little Britches Therapeutic Riding Program and be oriented to and trained to not just fulfill that dream, but also do good by both the program and the participants.
Absolutely. We're always looking for always volunteers. And we have a great team year to year. There's some people that just stay with us year after year. Then a lot of times we have kids from, like, high school that do their extra credit work with us.
Yeah.
And we sometimes have them for 4 or 5 years until they go off to college.
Wow.
And then a lot of those kids come back when they come back to Canada and they volunteer. So it's one of those programs that once you're there, you love it.
Yep.
And you don't want to not be a part of it.
And it's year round.
It is from March all the way to December.
Oh, okay. So folks that might be interested in contacting you to get involved in spring 2022, they should be doing that now.
Absolutely. Without a doubt.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, before we say farewell, we'll remind folks they can go to littlebritchesct.org. No matter where you're listening to the program, it's worth the ride. Bridgewater, right?
It's actually in Roxbury.
Oh, okay. And gorgeous Roxbury in Southern Litchfield County. So, but really, really easy to get to off of Route 84 and 8 if you're coming from elsewhere into the greater Waterbury or Southern Litchfield County area. So we want to thank you, Melissa Johnson, a 23-year participant and board member for Little Britches Therapeutic Riding. We're going to take a quick break, and then we're going to meet Marcy McBritt to talk more about how folks can get involved with Little Britches with some of their fundraising and an auction that's going on right now. So we'll be back to talk to Marcy in just a few moments. But Melissa, thank you so much for being part of the program. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. As we close out September, National Suicide Prevention and Awareness Month, we're celebrating our partners at United Way of Connecticut, which is committed to raising awareness about important mental health and suicide prevention resources. And we're happy to report that new funding from the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services and the Department of Children and Families is going to allow United Way of Connecticut 211 info line to double the size of its crisis team and ensure expanded availability to help Connecticut residents in need. Suicide is preventable, and we encourage anyone struggling with anxiety, depression, or facing mental health issues to engage proactively with existing support resources if you or someone you know is thinking about taking their own life. Just call 211. You are not alone. So as we heard before the break, this really cool program here, Little Britches Therapeutic Writing Initiative up in Roxbury, was founded way back in 1979, and they really are working to change the lives of people with disabilities using the movement of the horse, which, as we heard from Melissa, can improve physical strength, and it facilitates sensory integration and promotes emotional well-being for all of the folks who are participating. And they provide recreation for a lifetime. As we heard, about 25% of their current participants are over the age of 18. And we are now connected with Marcy Britt, and she has been a board member for Little Britches and a longtime volunteer and still doing it, co-chairing an auction that just started last week. So it's a way for anyone who's listening who may not be able to or want to get directly involved hands-on with Little Britches to go on and get a little something for yourself, or maybe line up a couple of holiday gifts, and at the same time benefit this program that you've been hearing so many good things about. So Marcy, let's start the conversation just talking about how you connected with Little Britches.
Oh, gee, I was a volunteer for the Special Olympics back in 1996 when the World Games were held here in Connecticut.
Yeah, I remember.
And the Yale facilities were where they were held. And I volunteered for the equestrian part of those Olympics and got really interested in therapeutic riding that way. So when I retired, I knew that I would want to do something with therapeutic riding, and Little Britches is practically in my backyard.
Oh, that's great. So as you mentioned before we turned on the microphone, you're kind of into IT and technology, but this is the kind of support you're lending the organization now. But tell me, across the time that you spent as a volunteer and a board member, some of the magic that you were able to witness between some of the folks. We talked a lot with Melissa about young people and her sons coming to the program. Tell us a little bit about what you've witnessed with adults that show up at Little Britches and maybe experiencing horses for the very first time in their 20s or 30s.
You know, any experience you can have with an equine is just absolutely wonderful. But to see somebody that was in a car accident or something like that have this outlet for their recreational, times, activities, yeah, and the smiles. I think just the smiles on people's faces. Some people, they never have been on a horse before. I have. I've also been an equestrian myself. Mm. It's just an incredible feeling. And, you know, it just makes people feel whole again. And you can see it in their faces when they ride.
Mm, that's great. You know, Melissa explained a lot about the various ways that folks can come and volunteer for the program and all the different kinds of jobs that they can do between the interaction with the horses and the clients and the kids and adults who come in for the program. But for people like you that do office work, administration, graphic arts, IT, there's also some opportunities there too, right?
Absolutely. We need people with all kinds of skill sets. Also, the sidewalking is terrific, too. It's great exercise. You're outside learning how to groom horses, how to be around horses. It's nice to get out of that desk for people that have been desk bound for most of their professional life. Mm. But we need people, you know, with all, like I said, all different skill sets, graphic arts, people that are good on the Internet. You know, posting things, social media, et cetera. And I'm sure that's true of most nonprofits. It's just the way it is these days.
Yeah, yeah.
With running a nonprofit, everything is so technology driven.
That's great. As we know, you mentioned the auction, this benefit auction that's going on right now has already started. But as we also know from auctions, it's not about the beginning that counts as much as it's the end that counts. And we're glad to be able to connect with you guys in time to be able to promote this so we can drive a bunch of people to the Little Britches Therapeutic Riding Auction that's happening online. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so as with so many nonprofits these days, we have had to find alternatives for in-person fundraising. So for the second year in a row, we've hosted a virtual, meaning online, auction. And that replaces our very popular Boots and Britches barbecue and ball, which where we had music and dancing and an online as well as a live auction. But last year we had to come up with something different, and we went completely with a live auction event. And so we're doing it again this year, and we're managing to keep the fun in fundraising, you know, by using this kind of method. It's great. It started on September 20th, and it will end on October 4th at 10 p.m., unless we decide for some reason to maybe extend it a little bit. But this year's auction, we have items that range in actual value from $15 for a set of horsey mugs to a week-long ski vacation up at Smuggler's Notch. There's also a week at a beautiful private home in Florida on the West Coast. That's been offered. So we really have to thank the generosity of many individuals and area businesses. We have about 65 items on the auction site that are available for bidding. And these include gift certificates, even at a renowned local restaurant. There are gift cards and certificates for all sorts of services, gourmet food items, artwork from local artists and photographers, jewelry, accessories, health and fitness classes. You can even bid on a tattoo or an astrology reading. And if you can't find anything that really strikes your fancy, we have the popular horseshoe donations, where you can buy a bale of hay for $10 or pay for a pony's hoof trimming for $50 or subsidize a rider for a session or a year, or you can donate your own amount.
Excellent.
So we think we have something for just about anyone who wants to buy or bid, either, as you mentioned before, gift items or for yourself.
That's so cool. And I'm looking at the website right now, littlebritchesct.org, and right there, all people got to do is go to the homepage and look across the menu bar and click on donate, and they can start their Little Bridges experience and philanthropy with a couple of clicks. So we hope folks will get involved. And can they go to the website to connect to the auction as well, Marcy?
Yeah, the best way to get to the auction site is to go to the Little Bridges homepage, and on the homepage that you can click on, and it'll take you right out to the auction site.
Excellent.
So that's really the easiest way to get there.
Or just go on your favorite search engine and put in Little Bridges. Thankfully, there aren't any competitors out there with the same name, because you guys have been around for so long, since 1979. Ask any search engine or ask any electronic voice helper in your home or on your phone and your mobile device to go to Little Bridges of Connecticut, and they'll take you right there. And then you could begin to get involved as a volunteer, as a donor, a supporter, or maybe get in on a piece of the action by participating at least through early October in their auction. Marcy Britt, we want to thank you for your work as a board member and volunteer, and for helping run and co-chair this auction. Melissa Johnson, our earlier guest, a 23-year participant with Little Bridges and current board member, for educating us about the importance and the critical role that equine therapy can play in the lives of so many individuals with disabilities and special needs. Thanks so much for your great work. Once again, littlebridgesct.org.
You can view the items easily just by going to the auction site. If you want to participate, that is, make a bid or buy an item, you do have to create an account on the site.
Folks, once again, we hope you'll support this great charity here in Southern Litchfield County that serves folks from all over the state. Thanks again. Well, as we wrap the program up this morning, it is exciting times for my guest, Eric Dillner, Chief Executive Director, and his organization, the Shoreline Arts Alliance. They have got incredible stuff happening as soon as just a few days from now and all the way into the fall and winter. We're going to tell you all about it. Eric, great to meet you. Thanks for being on the program.
Great to meet you. Thank you so much for having me.
So this organization's been around for about 40 years, but it's most exciting right here in the early fall of 2021, because this week you're not only kind of cutting the ribbon on a brand new headquarters, but you're involved in a very, very important public health initiative, Masks for the Arts. Tell us about the event that's coming up this week.
Yeah, well, this is just I'm so excited, I can't even tell you. We're in the first few weeks of our new office space, and we're inviting arts institutions, artists that have visitors, anyone who needs a mask for their arts programming, for their patrons, for themselves, to get some masks. So we've got $500,000 masks donated by the Rossi Foundation to the Shoreline Arts Alliance for us to parcel out. So Wednesday, September 29th at 10 o'clock in the morning, we're going to be in Madison on Boston Post Road. I'll give you the address, 206 Boston Post Road, and celebrating this with people. And literally we'll have a truck out in front, and we'll be loading cars with masks. So it's what an exciting time for us to help provide that. This actually comes out of a program that we've been doing since the pandemic started, which is called Reopening Connecticut Arts Venues Through Science-Based Safety, myself and the Dean of Yale School of Public Health have been doing webinar series for arts institutions. It has the word Connecticut in it, but honestly, it's been around the world. People have been watching this. Most recently, we just hit the 15,000 mark of folks watching our programs, which is very exciting.
Well, that's wonderful, because I imagine arts organizations who are so hard pressed because of the downsizing or outright elimination of public exhibits and shows and events and activities, presentations, they've been suffering quite a lot, and they're looking for ways to try to re-engage. And what a better way to do it than through public health partnerships like you're doing with the Masks for the Arts program.
Absolutely. It's been a real way for them to connect with each other and find new ways. We claim that our effort is to help them with preparedness and basically clarity when it comes to what are the guidelines, what should they be following to help people with the end result of consumer confidence. Mm-hmm. So once again, that's why this leads perfectly right into Masks for the Arts, because as we know, masks, though none of us love to wear them, I don't think, we know that actually helps us all feel safer in spaces. Boy, if you're vaccinated and then we have the masks along with it, you know, the chances are so low that we're transmitting this, so it really allows us to for the arts to get going.
Yeah. So do you envision this as participants coming and taking a portion of these 500,000 masks that you're going to be distributing, and then warehousing them at their own facilities, so that when and if they are able to have public events, they'll have a huge stock of masks that they can share with every participant?
That's exactly right. So right now today is the deadline actually so it's perfect timing, the deadline for making a reservation for your masks for next Wednesday. Mm. Anything after that, we'll have to find another time to do it, because, you know, if some of these orders are 25,000 masks, some are 1,000, some are 250, you know, so they're all over the plate. But
well, hopefully with 500,000, they'll be able to get around. And
there should be plenty. Yeah. So I encourage people to email us at office@shorelinearts.org if they're interested to let us know who they are and what they're looking for, and if they can join us on Wednesday.
Sure. And shorelinearts.org is the main website for folks that might be listening who want to learn more or get involved with some of the great stuff that you're doing, including photographers, because now's the time to get involved in this annual competition, the Images Photography Exhibition and Competition with the Shoreline Arts Alliance. Give us a little insight into what that's all about, Eric.
Well, Images is a Connecticut-based for Connecticut photographers. It's actually been around since Shoreline Arts Alliance came along, so it's about 40-year-old competition. It's extraordinary. We have the professional photographers to the, I'll call it the novice, not the one-hit wonder, but the one who can put together at least three really spectacular photos and submit them. The submissions are in process. The deadline is October 3rd. There's no theme to the show. It's all about wonderful art that comes through the camera. As long as photography is the main artistic use there, media, then it's good. So we see photography, created in many, many different ways. And then we have outside judges who come from outside of Connecticut to come in and take a look at all this art. And then we'll be exhibiting it this year in Lyme at the Lyme Academy of Fine Arts, which will be wonderful. And that'll actually run all the way from November through December there. So we're really excited to get that going. The pandemic taught us to do many of our events like this via Zoom.
Yep.
So we have a juror's discussion, which will be fantastic for people to learn from the three jurors what they see about all the photography that was chosen for the show. It's an amazing show. So again, yeah, to have them check out our website here, shorelinearts.org. whether you're a photographer who wants to get into the exhibit or you're somebody who just wants to enjoy that that art that comes through.
Well, at the core of Shoreline Arts Alliance's mission is this commitment to educate, encourage, enrich, and engage. And that also means engaging with educational entities, which you're doing with this Expressions in Art program, a real resource for teens and younger people.
Yeah, this is a new program. We're actually starting next week, and we think it's going to continue on for a long time. It's an extraordinary program where students are able to create their visual arts on a platform together. So they'll all be actually meeting via a Zoom type program. They'll be able to create their own art. They can show their art to each other as they're doing it. And this really comes out of the idea that many of our students have struggled to connect with other people due to this pandemic. And so we met with a art therapist who helped us come up with the idea that their challenge as therapists these days is honestly that they have a lot of folks coming to them individually. They don't have time to meet with groups. So we're taking on that aspect of actually forming groups for artists to connect. This is for high school students. It's online, so the great thing is that they can be from pretty much anywhere to do this. Low cost, it's just a little over $100 for like a 6-week course. It's a very low cost because we've got some amazing donors who've built this program with us. So, educate, encourage, enrich, engage is what it's all about. And this, we hope, is going to do a lot of that because we need to keep the mental health of our children strong and healthy. And this is just one of the ways that we're doing that this year.
Well, in the last minute or two that we have with you, Eric, utilize this time to reinforce the fact that while the word Shoreline is in your name, certainly the Shoreline Arts Alliance will welcome artists for the most part from anywhere.
Yeah, our office is on the shoreline.
That's it.
That's the reality. But we serve 24 towns under the Department of Economic and Community Development, the Connecticut Office of the Arts, specifically for advocacy and those kinds of things. But most of our programming is at least statewide, and much of it actually goes beyond. So though we have our offices in on the shoreline, and we're so fortunate to be in the beautiful shoreline of Connecticut, we really are out and about all around. So I encourage arts lovers, artists, and our arts organizations to come our way, because we're out there to help these businesses grow, help the artists grow. We provide a lot of scholarships for, again, high school students who are embarking on maybe a career, but maybe also just it be a really important part of their life in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do a lot of business development also with high school students to get them ready for a life with art as a big part of it.
Fantastic.
But make sure that they understand the business side too.
All right.
So we've got a lot going on.
Well, Eric Dillner, thank you so much. You've really helped educate myself and our listeners this morning, and we hope all kinds of folks who are listening will go to shorelinearts.org to learn more about getting involved or supporting all the great work you're doing. Eric is the Chief Executive Director for the Shoreline Arts Alliance. For 40 years, they've been enriching Connecticut's cultural landscape through their programs, arts advocacy, and mission to transform lives through the arts. Eric, great to meet you, and we'll talk to you again soon. You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette
at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.